Hello and welcome to The Top Story, a podcast with the headlines of the day from our correspondents around the world. I'm Qi Zhi. Coming up in this edition, the political situation in Haiti has been in limbo since Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced his resignation. The Health Ministry of Gaza says two separate Israeli attacks on Thursday killed at least 29 Palestinians waiting for aid. And the 2024 presidential election in Russia is underway. We begin in the Americas. Tensions in Haiti are still running high. The political situation has been in limbo since Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced his resignation on Monday. Local gang leader Jimmy Chrisia is threatening whoever will lead the planned transitional council. Intense violence has engulfed the Caribbean nation. On Thursday, there was a shootout in one neighborhood and an attack on a police academy. Earlier this month, the National Penitentiary caught fire after a mass prison break. The unrest has worsened the humanitarian situation, displacing hundreds of thousands of people. Dan Collins reports from the Dominican border with Haiti.
We're here on the border of the Dominican Republic with Haiti. Haitians coming over to the Dominican Republic is market day. Now, they used to have unlimited access to come to the market here 7 days a week. Now that has been limited to 2 days a week, and hence the desperation of many Haitians to come over to sell their products and also buy the necessities that they need from the wealthier neighbor. What we're seeing here is a kind of desperation of the Haitians at this time. The UN says that a half of the 11.4 million Haitians are suffering from hunger, and 1.4 million of them are starving at the moment. And this is just the latest in a series of crises and the chronic instability of the country. What we've seen in the last 2 weeks is gang violence waged against the Haitian people, ports being stormed, the international airport in Port-au-Prince, the capital, being put under siege, and also a situation of chaos and violence, particularly in the capital, that is spread out into the rest of the country. 80% of the capital is controlled by gangs at the moment, and demanding the resignation that we saw earlier this week of Ariel Henry, the Prime Minister of the last 3 years, the man that took over as an unelected leader when Jovenel Moïse, the former president, was assassinated in July 2021. What we're seeing in Haiti is a continuation of the chronic crisis which is taking place here. But what we're really feeling here is a humanitarian crisis, with many people desperate to get across the border just to barter and exchange goods and take back what they need, as if they're preparing for a crisis, a pending crisis which comes, as there's currently a power vacuum in the country and a situation of, if you like, waiting to see what happens next with the political crisis.
That was Dan Collins on the crisis in Haiti. In the United States, as the world waits a presidential rematch between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, international conflicts are set to play a significant role in the choices of American voters. The incumbent Democratic president continues to commit support and aid in the Ukraine and the Gaza conflicts. But the Republican frontrunner has maintained his American First approach from his last administration. Nathan King reports.
During primary voting in Fairfax, Virginia, we talked to Egyptian-American Khalil Ibrahim.
What broke my heart last night, a 10-year-old guy, boy, he died from starvation. Can you imagine this? And this is happening right now with our support. It's a shame. It's a shame that he doesn't call for a ceasefire right now. And we pay for this. I pay from my taxes to kill people there. Why? He has to stop this immediately.
Vote for Palestine.
Like many other Arab Americans who've traditionally voted Democrat, Khalil decided not to back Joe Biden's re-election as president due to his backing of Israel and a perceived lack of action on helping displaced and needy Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Perhaps not since the calamity that followed the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 have global conflicts had such a prominent place in the minds of Americans in a presidential election year. From the grinding conflict in Ukraine to the plight of the Palestinians in Gaza, foreign affairs has a place at the ballot box this November, and the consequences are potentially very real for both parties. 2 years into the Ukraine conflict, U.S. support for Kyiv is wavering. A $60 billion aid bill is currently held up in Congress, and President Biden used his State of the Union speech to plead for the aid to be approved.
Ukraine can stop Putin if we stand with Ukraine and provide the weapons that it needs to defend itself.
Biden's poll numbers are low, and in fact, they have been ever since the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in August 2021. A president who for decades has prided himself on a mastery of foreign policy has now become, it seems, hostage to events. And then there is his challenger, Donald Trump, who was elected in 2016 in part on his promise to end foreign wars with a policy of America first. His administration made the deal with the Taliban to pull out of Afghanistan, meanwhile offering tepid support for the transatlantic and Pacific alliances. He even tried to make peace with Pyongyang. Controversially, Trump recently suggested that any NATO member that doesn't meet the suggested spending of 2% of his GDP on national defense would be left on their own against a resurgent Russia. That met with a rare rebuke from Washington's transatlantic partners.
Let me clearly say, due to recent developments, that any relativizing of NATO's collective defense guarantee is irresponsible and dangerous and is only in Russia's interests. Nobody should play or bargain with Europe's security.
Of course, domestic issues like the economy, immigration, reproductive rights will be uppermost of the concerns in Americans' minds when they go to the polls. But with all these endless foreign wars and the debate over U.S. military commitments, expect foreign policy and conflicts to feature much more heavily this year. And remember, with just tens of thousands of votes sometimes deciding U.S. elections, what happens outside the United States could really affect who is in the White House next year.
That was Nathan King on the U.S. presidential vote. In the Middle East, the health ministry in Gaza says two separate Israeli attacks on Thursday killed at least 29 Palestinians waiting for aid and injured over 150 others. It says the attacks happened at 8 distribution points in central and northern Gaza. The Israeli military has denied the attacks, describing the reports as false. The development comes as aid groups and governments try to get more humanitarian relief into the Strip. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will resist international pressure over operating in Rafah. Alex Kadir has more from Jerusalem.
Well, Israel's intentions for Rafah are very, very clear. They've said consistently that they will launch that military operation in Gaza. We heard Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, saying in response to the US putting pressure on Israel not to go into Rafah, Benjamin Netanyahu says, we will go in there. He and many Israeli officials see an operation in Rafah as the final stage of to get rid of Hamas. And the red line expressed by Benjamin Netanyahu was one of never allowing the October 7th atrocities for being repeated. And for from his perspective, that means that operation in Rafah to, quote, finish the job. And that's certainly been consistently the position of the Israeli government. We heard the defense minister, Gallant, also saying that anybody who thinks Israel is delaying an operation in Rafah will find very soon that there is nowhere the Israeli forces can't go. So that Israeli position very, very consistent. But the international pressure against it is also huge. Israel's closest allies, the United States, calling an operation in Rafah a red line. We've seen Germany saying that an operation in Rafah would lead to a further humanitarian catastrophe. Those allies pushing very, very, very strongly against any Israeli operation in Rafah. We know that there's a possibility that may be delayed somewhat if a ceasefire deal perhaps could be reached, but certainly massive international pressure on Israel not to go into Rafah. So far, Israel not budging.
That was Alex Kadir in Jerusalem. Hamas has proposed a Gaza ceasefire deal to mediators, which includes hostage prisoner swap. Media reports say the first stage of Israeli hostage release will include women, children, the elderly and the ill. The reports also say the swap is an exchange of the release of Palestinian prisoners. an aid ship is sailing toward Gaza from Cyprus in a test of a sea corridor into the enclave. Noah Harazing has more from Rafah.
We do know that way before the start of the month of Ramadan, Hamas and also Egypt and Qatar have been very much working on the negotiations at least reach a ceasefire, a truce agreement before the beginning of the month of Ramadan. And now, as we are on the fifth day of Ramadan, people here on the ground, they are suffering. The people are suffering. The people are putting pressure on Israel and also on Hamas to reach a ceasefire agreement. The proposal of Hamas was very clear. It is very similar to the previous proposals. I mean, we are talking about one of the main conditions, which is allowing displaced people who have evacuated their homes from northern Gaza to go back to northern Gaza. And this condition was one of the main problems, if we can say, in the negotiations between Hamas and Israel. For now, we are waiting on a reply and answer from the Israeli side, even though the Israeli side had also a very clear position that they will not allow displaced Palestinians from going back to northern Gaza. And they were actually talking about land invading Rafah and building camps for displaced people inside Rafah.
That was Noor Herzing reporting in Rafah. Turning to Russia, voters are heading to the polls in the 2024 presidential election. More than 90,000 polling stations are operating nationwide from Friday to Sunday. Mikhail Badovit has more from Moscow.
Well, the atmosphere is calm right now. Voting has begun, but this is going to be the first time that voting is going to take place across 3 days. So there's plenty of time to vote for Russians, and electronic voting is also available. So people have started to line up to vote, but we are expecting that it's going to be more crowded over the weekend, especially on Sunday. For the first time, voting is also taking place in what Russia calls its new territories, 4 of them in Ukraine. So this is also significant for Moscow. There are 112.3 million people who are potentially able to vote in this election, and another 1.9 million abroad who can vote for Russia. Now, incumbent President Vladimir Putin faces 3 other candidates on the ballot, but they all support his policy, so none of them really stand a chance against him in this vote. And thanks to some amendments in 2020, Putin's own presidential tally has been reset to 0 this year, so potentially has the right to stay in power until 2036.
That was Mikhail Badovit in Moscow on the Russian presidential vote. Finally, in China, Chinese President Xi Jinping has met with visiting Angolan President Joao Lourenço in Beijing. The Chinese leader hailed the China-Angola traditional friendship, noting that the two countries celebrated the 40th anniversary of diplomatic ties last year. The two leaders have announced the elevation of bilateral ties to a comprehensive strategic cooperative partnership following their talks. The Angolan president's 4-day tour is at the invitation of President Xi Jinping. Lourenço is also expected to make a stop in the eastern province of Shandong. Huang Yue has more on his schedule.
Angolan President Joao Lourenço went to the Tiananmen Square to lay flowers in front of the monument to people's heroes to pay tribute to those who sacrificed their lives to safeguard the country and the people of China. President Lourenço will pay a visit to East China's Shandong province, and according to the Angolan side, in Shandong, he will maintain contact with those responsible for the productive sectors in textile, pharmaceutical, and agricultural industries. And in an earlier press conference, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said that last year China and Angola celebrated the 40th anniversary of their diplomatic ties, and China expects that this trip will inject new impetus to the all-round and in-depth development of their bilateral relations and push for new progress in their friendly cooperation. Yeah, Angola is located in southwestern Africa with a coastline of over 1,600 kilometers and a linear area of over 1 million square kilometers is an important maritime outlet for Central and Southern Africa. And in terms of natural resources, Angola has rich oil, natural gas and minerals, including diamond, phosphate, gold. And let's take diamond, for example. Angola has abundant diamond resources with a total reserves of over 1 billion carats, and half of them are of gem quality. It also has abundant oil resources, and it's China's largest source of imported oil in Africa. Last year, the two countries celebrated their four decades of diplomatic ties, and China is both the top export destination and import source for Angola, and Angola has emerged as the second largest trading partner with China in Africa. And so far, more than 400 Chinese companies are operating in Angola, and these companies have contributed largely in Angola's infrastructure development, including roads, railways, hospitals, schools, housing units. Chinese programs have also facilitated the training for Angola doctors and agricultural experts and also security personnel. And analysts say that this trip by the Angolan president this time will provide the chance for the two countries to evaluate the existing agreements and plan new areas for cooperation and investment, especially for the private sector.
That was Huang Yue on the Angolan president's visit to China. Angola is among the countries actively participating in the joint construction of the Belt and Road Initiative. Over the past decade, China has funded a series of investment projects in the African nation and shared its expertise in sectors such as water, energy supply and grain transformation. Enoch Sekolia gives us a timeline for the growth of bilateral ties.
China upped its assistance to Angola in the early 2000s, a period marked by the country's emergence from a prolonged civil conflict and its urgent need for extensive reconstruction. The Chinese government came and accorded the African country substantial financial support for various critical infrastructure projects. Water treatment and transmission systems were built to help secure energy supplies and improve local living standards. Constructed by Power Construction Corp of China, or Power China, the Soyo Kapari Power Transmission and Transformation Project is the most extensive transmission and substation project in the country. It has the highest voltage standard, the highest voltage level, and the longest transmission distance. Since it set up its base in Angola in 2004, Power China has been involved in 360 completed and ongoing projects worth nearly $10 billion. These projects are across a number of sectors, including power, roads, airports, and water infrastructure. Indeed, Chinese entities have invested just shy of $14 billion in the African country over the last decade. The bulk of these investments are in energy. Other projects include the Kakulo Kabaka Hydro Power Station, which is referred to as the Three Gorges Project of Africa. This grand project is being built by the Hubei-based Gechoba Group Company. The hydroelectric venture, positioned along the middle reaches of the Kwanza River, is approximately 230 kilometers from the capital city of Luanda. Comprising a principal power station alongside an ecological counterpart, the project is designed to have an installed capacity of 2,172 megawatts. Meanwhile, telecommunication is another sector which is seeing significant Chinese investment. Power China has invested $250 million in its infrastructure.
That was Enoch Sekolia on how China-Angola ties have evolved over the years. Now recapping today's headlines. The political situation in Haiti has been in limbo since Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced his resignation, and tensions remain high. The Health Ministry of Gaza says two separate Israeli attacks on Thursday killed at least 29 Palestinians waiting for aid. And the 2024 presidential election in Russia is underway. That's it for this edition of The Top Story, a podcast that brings you world headlines every weekday. For more news in politics, business, sports and culture, you can subscribe to The Beijing Hour, a one-hour podcast news magazine program. We welcome and appreciate all ratings and reviews. I'm Qi Zhi. Thanks for listening.